With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese and Ryan Marine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365's Sports Car Racing Podcast in Las Vegas. I'm Ryan Marine. John DeGeese joining me from Chicago. Busy week of news to recap, John, and some big stories that came out today, starting with the announcement that Circuit of the Americas will be replacing Interlagos on the current WEC calendar. Not a huge surprise there, but still interesting that, that there was a change made, but it was interesting to see the selection, and of course it raises some questions about what this event is going to be like. What can you tell us about this decision?
Absolutely, Ryan. And while we haven't had a lot of news in this past week, it all sort of hit Monday morning with the FIA-WEC announcing that the 6 hours of Sao Paulo has been replaced by a round at Circuit of the Americas. It'll still happen in February, but the new date will be February 22nd to 23rd. It'll be a six-hour race. I guess this doesn't come as a huge surprise, considering the issues that have been reported in recent weeks on Sao Paulo and the Interlagos circuit. There had been a lot of financial difficulties with the promoters and the local government. I spoke to Gerard Nouveau a few weeks ago, and he still had described it as, you know, serious doubts and concerns over that race, and they were working on backup plans. And at the time, we were thinking that Kyle Ami could have been a good option for the WEC, but instead, Gerard indicated to us that it was not an option that could be done in the matter of a few months. It's something more of a long-term perspective race in the future. And that sort of narrowed down the options for a replacement round to a place that the WEC has gone to previously. And I think the two options were obviously COTA or Mexico City. And for whatever reason, I think logistics, it seemed to make a lot more sense for WEC to return to COTA. So this race happens 1 month before the second doubleheader, you would say now, for WEC at Sebring. I sort of wish that it could have been put a little closer. You know, it would have been cool to see WEC race on the same weekend as the SRO America at COTA. It would have been a nice little doubleheader there, and it would have meant a three-week gap only between the rounds, and maybe it could have saved teams a little bit of money if they had, you know, budgeted that factor into it. But we don't know if that was even a possibility. But nonetheless, the 2019-2020 WEC calendar is now finally officially confirmed, so we have no other questions about that. So good news for all involved. It'll be interesting to see how WEC handles this COTA event, because it was always a race that struggled for fans, for attendance, and now with this being put in at the last minute, I'm sure that's not going to really help things.
No, it's not going to help, unfortunately, so we'll see how that plays out. Some other big news on Monday from a driver lineup perspective, with a longtime Lamborghini factory driver switching homes. He'll have a different home next year with Audi, speaking, of course, of Mirko Bortolotti.
Longtime Lamborghini factory driver. He announced earlier in the morning that he was leaving Lamborghini, and with news to be announced shortly after. And that news was that he's joining Audi as a factory driver. It's sort of a bit of a shock, if you ask me. Here's an Italian driver, worked his way up through the Lamborghini ladder system through, you know, Squadra Corsa, and has had an extreme amount of success with the manufacturer. He's kind of been the poster child for Lamborghini Squadra Corsa, being the first driver to win a 24-hour race for Lamborghini. He'd won the Blancpain GT Series overall, Endurance Sprint Cup titles, Rolex 24 winner, Mobil 1 12 Hours of Sebring winner. I think he's had 25 wins out of 151 race starts with Lamborghini, and he's made this drastic change to Audi. Obviously a sister brand, all under the Volkswagen group, but it's quite interesting. Also in the news was Patrick Niedenhauser will also be a factory driver for Audi. It So German manufacturers pretty much bolstering its lineup there with the addition of those two drivers. Audi's also committed a return to the Intercontinental GT Challenge powered by Pirelli, Nürburgring 24, and FIA GT World Cup. So it sounds like we can expect a very similar program from Audi next year, but with the addition of these two drivers. And this very much could be what we talked about on last week's show, I think, in that, you know, there's a clash with the ADAC GT Masters, two clashes with ADAC GT Masters and Intercontinental GT Challenge, and Audi was sort of scratching their heads trying to figure out what to do in terms of the driver situation. Having these two drivers now on board as factory drivers, I think that might help their situation. We'll have to wait and see how those drivers are allocated.
Some WEC news, some hypercar news. We spoke on the show previously about the surprise news, quite frankly, that Peugeot had a hypercar program waiting in the wings. And I think the one of the questions that first came up when this news came out was, what might this do to potential convergence talks between the WEC and IMSA for DPI and hypercar? We did get some quotes on that subject here recently. What did we learn? What do you think we can read from those quotes?
Yeah, I spoke to Gerard Nouveau about that during the Kyle on the 9 Hour when he made an appearance there evaluating the track for a potential WEC race in the future. And I asked him the question because I know it was on everybody's minds. And he stood back and said, absolutely not. This has no effect at all. Our talks with IMSA on DPI are strong as it's ever been. He said it was no secret that they had a very productive meeting in Miami recently. He said, you know, we have to be diligent, we have to be patient, we have to, you know, not lead to conclusions just yet, but things are headed in a really good direction. So I think that news is extremely good. And the other interesting thing I got out of it was that Gerard basically admitted that there's not many other manufacturers looking at a pure hypercar program. He said they're very thankful for Peugeot to jump in. They're looking forward to it. It's great, but there aren't really any other manufacturers ready to commit. So I think if you have three, that's good, but you're always wanting more manufacturers, and that's where the DPI possibilities will come in, because you have a number of different manufacturer sort of sitting on the sidelines right now waiting to see if DPI goes global in order for them to commit. I think the biggest one is Ford. There's also been a lot of talk around Lamborghini, Porsche as well. And so as soon as something like this is confirmed and committed by both parties, I think you're going to see the floodgates open. It would benefit, you know, for sure the ACO, Le Mans, WEC, but also IMSA, because it looks like you might not get some of these manufacturers in DPI 2.0 if it's not a global platform. So it's great news that talks are still ongoing. I think that we should hopefully get some further news, you know, maybe something official by the Rolex 24. I asked Gerard that question. He sort of said, let the presidents make that decision. That's Pierre Fion with the ACO and Jim France as the chairman of IMSA. So, you know, we'll wait and see what happens, but I'm expecting some kind of news either from some manufacturers or from the sanctioning bodies in Daytona in January, whether it leads to convergence or not, or potential DPI programs. So I think it's going to be quite a busy season opening weekend for sure in terms of news for the future.
Is it possible that convergence would be attractive for Peugeot as well, especially given the news that's been out there in the automotive industry circles with the proposed merger that appears to be going through between Peugeot and Fiat Chrysler, maybe having a ability to take one of their products and demonstrate it in North America in IMSA? Might that be something that would be attractive for Peugeot?
I think so, because we've seen Peugeot in the U.S. before with their LMP1 program. That's when they weren't even selling cars.
Right.
And from what I can tell, maybe this was the plan before the merger with Fiat, but Peugeot was planning to re-enter the U.S. market in 2022. And when does the DPI platform come on? 2022. I think that's just a coincidence. I'm not really trying to be too much of a conspiracy theorist here, but you know, it would be quite something if all this sort of falls into place, and all of a sudden we can see Peugeot potentially even just contest the big races like they had done in the past in the ALMS days. So I think that this is all on the right track. The other element you could sort of look at and sort of question is the Peugeot a hypercar? Could it actually end up being a DPI? You know, so if the manufacturer wanted to make something more cost effective, I think you can go the DPI route instead of hypercar. But now, given that DPIs are still not officially eligible in WEC, you can't go out and say that. So I think there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. Peugeot said they'll have more details on their program early next year. That could be corresponding to when all this is going to be announced as well. So again, not saying that, I have no evidence saying that Peugeot's project is not a hypercar, but if I had a guess, it perhaps could be built around a DPI set of regulations, because it would actually make it a little more easier to race in America as well. But speaking to Gerard, and we've yet to really talk to IMSA on this whole matter, the latest updates on this, and I guess John Doonan would be the best person to speak to on this, but if DPIs would be allowed in Le Mans and in WEC, there should be a reciprocal effect where the hypercar would be allowed in IMSA as well. Whether that would be for a full season or just the key races, that all remains to be seen. But I think the idea is to sort of share the two platforms and not kill one off per se. So whatever route Peugeot would go, I think they'd be safe. But you know, if you're looking for a real cost-effective program, I think DPI is the place you got to look at right now.
Really interesting. Definitely something to watch here in the months to come. And staying on the hypercar subject, we've talked in the past about Aston Martin's hypercar program, some question marks around that. There hasn't been a ton of information here recently, although we have gotten word that our motorsport feels like they could be fielding a car as soon as the 2020-2021 season. And again, from the WEC's perspective, this has to be some welcome news to hear that things appear to be progressing on the Aston Martin front.
Yeah, there's been a real lack of news, lack of information on Aston Martin. There's been some talk within the WEC paddock that, you know, prior to Peugeot's announcement, that WEC had 1.5 manufacturers committed, and that half, I think, was Aston Martin. And we're still waiting. We're still optimistic that this will happen. Our motorsport, I think, seems to be in the middle of all of it, because back at Le Mans, we had heard talk that there would be a factory Multimatic run effort alongside an R Motorsport effort as more of like a semi-works customer program. And there was even reports in the summer months that there could be 4 Aston Martin Valkyries on the grid next year. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think there's a lot of financial issues both with Aston Martin Lagonda and also potentially our motorsport. They may be stretching themselves a little too thin with a lot of different programs in the air right now. We have to wait and see how all that unfolds. But Jake Kilshaw spoke with one of the team principals at our motorsport during the Kyalami race, and he was open that they could field a hypercar in the debut season. He says it could happen if all the right pieces fall into place. And there's a lot of different pieces floating around at our motorsport right now. They have to get a new engine supplier / chassis builder for DTM next year, as they've parted ways with HWA. There's a potential Intercontinental GT Challenge program for their GT3 Aston Martins. There's other programs in the works. So a hypercar would be something at the top of that. And we're talking, you know, a lot of investment here. So I wouldn't say this is a done deal. It's probably far from being a done deal. But whatever happens with this Valkyrie hypercar, somebody's going to have to run it. And we know Multimatic is involved in the development of the car, and they were tipped to be the race operators for the factory program, but that's sort of gone quiet recently. And I think that is due to the financial issues with Aston Martin. So our motorsport could end up just being the de facto factory team by next year if the situation doesn't improve. So I think that's where the door is being left open for next year for the debut season of the hypercar regs.
Well, let's leave the hypercar talk behind for now and switch over to some IMSA discussion, as we have done now the last couple of episodes. Let's dedicate a little segment here to the IMSA silly season. We do have some more information about where some drivers are headed, some drivers where they're not going to be in some cases. So we'll start with Madison Snow, who will be back with Paul Miller Racing, rejoining Brian Sellers. That duo won the championship in the GT Daytona class just a couple of years ago before Madison sat out last year. I think this is very positive for a lot of reasons, and it keeps that Paul Miller Racing team on the grid, which is good to see. It's a fantastic team, and that duo has been really remarkable when they've been able to race together.
Yeah, there was a lot of question marks over whether Paul Miller would return. I remember sitting in their transporter, I think, around Laguna Seca time, and there were some worried faces, and I posed the question, well, could Madison return? And they were all like, well, he's gold rated by IMSA. And I'm like, yeah, but he's been out of the cockpit for a year. You might as well give him a shot, see if IMSA would reconsider. And they're like, oh, well, maybe, we don't know. You know, and so it was really indecisive at that time. But I sort of thought that was the most realistic option for them. And it, you know, not saying that I suggested it. I'm sure they had they had evaluated it numerous times. Madison was actually at the Laguna Seca round, I believe. And so he had tested the car earlier in the year, and then he was all of a sudden confirmed for the Michelin Encore. And when that had been released, we got clarification from IMSA that they were standing down on Madison's rating of gold by IMSA. They'll honor whatever the FIA rates him. And as it turns out, he's remained a silver by the FIA for next year, and that opened the door for him to do a full season with Paul Miller again, returning with Brian Sellers. So, like you said, this is excellent news for the series. I know it puts a real stacked lineup in GTD, but I think we're going to have a couple of those next year between the different various lineups. And at this point, you know, I don't know about you, Ryan, but I'm getting to the point of we need to sort of maybe eliminate driver ratings in GTD. That's just my opinion, but it's gotten so controversial here, and we can't lay blame on the drivers or the teams for doing their best. And especially in this case with Paul Miller Racing, with Madison bringing significant budget to that program, if Madison wasn't able to race, like I said earlier, there's a chance the team might not be on the grid. So I'm glad that IMSA came to their senses on this. Yeah, it's going to make it more difficult, I think, for other teams to compete. But at the same time, I think this is the wake-up call for everybody to sort of maybe perhaps get behind the idea of maybe abolishing driver ratings altogether in GTD. What do you think?
I think it would be welcome in a lot of respects, especially because it just hasn't been able to be utilized correctly on a regular basis, right? Doesn't it always seem like there's one or two lineups that just stick out, that this is not the way that the rules were intended? And to be honest, I don't think that Madison and Brian are one of those, because Madison does bring a significant chunk of the budget to the team. I thought that his promotion to gold last year by IMSA was a bit of a head-scratcher, especially when you looked around at some of the other lineups that were allowed to remain in place, where the AM in the lineup, I think you could look at and say, this is a legitimate pro driver. Full stop. I think the championship winning team at Meyer Shank Racing is the perfect example there. So
and then you look at Trent Hindman,
right?
He's been retained as a silver,
exactly,
for next year. So at least they're not picking preferences, they're not taking sides, because that would have been the absolute worst thing for Madison to get reclassified as a silver, you know, or IMSA to abolish the gold rating, and then all of a sudden guys like Trent Hindman or Zach Robichon to get upgraded to gold, and then that would have been completely ludicrous. And IMSA didn't do that, so I'm grateful for that consistency now. At least we have something there, but there are still some drivers that are gold who maybe should be silver.
Yes, I think there's plenty that have a legitimate grievance on those grounds. But to be honest, I think as long as it's not driving away teams and making it difficult for teams to put cars on the grid, then the state of affairs as it is right now is okay. If they were really struggling for gentleman drivers and you weren't filling out grids, then yeah, you maybe you want to look into a bronze driver mandate or something like that, like we've seen in LMP2. But because the grid actually seems quite strong, which is nice to see, because there were some concerns just, really in the last 12 months, that IMSA went to work to try and make sure this class stayed as strong as it has been. So given the fact that it does seem to have a pretty bumper crop of driver lineups and teams at the moment, I don't think anything knee-jerk is needed at the moment. The driver ratings thing, it's flawed from the beginning, right? We've talked about this before. And unfortunately, you're going to have some people who are victims of this system. But I think at least as far as this upcoming season is concerned, IMSA has done the right thing, and it seems like they're making the best of a situation that's going to be challenging no matter what, just by the nature of the driver rating system.
Yeah, I'd agree. And you know, maybe it's something to look into the future. Maybe not completely abolish the driver ratings, maybe make it be where, you know, you can't have two platinums together, but you're maybe permitted two golds, or, you know, come up with something interesting where, you know, you can allow a greater flexibility of driver lineups and maybe find a way to recognize a bronze driver in a better way, because there was definitely a push during the middle of the season to maybe make a subcategory for a bronze enforced GTD class, and I still think that would make it really interesting for mm-hmm. a lot of the gentleman drivers out there. You know, guys like Richard Heinstead, Ben Keating, who's actually only doing an endurance season this year, but John Potter, we'll see if he returns. There's still some talk there that Magnus might be on the grid. We'll have to wait and see. But yeah, nonetheless, I think we should stop talking about driver ratings for now. Let's see how the season progresses. Let's see what the entry list looks like. There's still some teams yet to announce their efforts. So yeah, but I didn't mean to go on this big long tangent about it, but I think that, you know, it's great to see some changes for next year, and I'd say at least some consistency on IMSA's part of not, you know, picking and choosing drivers over the other, and I think that's what maybe got things a little bit controversial last year when they bumped Madison up, and then they had other guys like Trent Hidman, who we knew was almost just as quick as Madison, if not quicker, on race as a silver. So
yeah, last thing I'll say on the subject is, if I'm in IMSA's shoes, I want to meddle with it as little as possible. That way, if there is anything controversial, you have to point your finger someplace else. The moment that they stepped in and made the decision to elevate Madison on their own initiative, that's where they're going to start getting the heat like they did. If you let the FIA handle it, then it becomes their problem, and that might be the way to handle it moving forward. At any rate, let's get to some other topics here. Unfortunately, a long-standing member of the Corvette Racing Endurance lineup will not be in that role looking ahead to next year. Mike Rockenfeller will have to be stood down from his role with Corvette Racing due to an unfortunate clash on the calendar with his full-season DTM commitments.
Yeah, this was something that's been in the works for a few months, but we didn't have Rocky actually confirm it on the record until recently, and this is basically due to a clash with the 24 Hours of Le Mans and the DTM round in Anderstorp in Sweden. And bizarrely enough, they are on the same weekend, and there is no effort being made to move that Swedish DTM race off the calendar into a different weekend. So it not only affects Mike Rockenfeller, it also affects Paul DiResta if he returns to DTM, as well as other guys like Rene Rast, who sometimes is always in the big race, and as well as Loic Duval. So it impacts a bunch of drivers, but I think it's going to hurt Rockenfeller the most, because Corvette has elected to go with a different driver for the entire endurance season. So Rocky had done the last two 24 Hours of Le Mans as part of the full endurance lineup, and prior to that, he was part of the North American endurance lineup with that team, where Jordan Taylor took over that seat at Le Mans. Ultimately, Corvette wanted stability in having the same driver compete in all four races, Daytona, Sebring, Le Mans, and Petit Le Mans, and that's why they ended up choosing Rocky for the last two seasons. now they're going to continue with that same kind of philosophy for the 3/63 car. We hope to get an announcement soon on the driver. I've heard a lot of people giving some suggestions of drivers. There's a lot of different drivers out on the market right now. I've seen a lot of people speculate on who this new driver could be, but so far I haven't seen it mentioned yet anywhere. And I'll admit that it's a bit of a surprise when I heard who it was as well, and hopefully it will be announced pretty soon. But there's a lot of drivers on the market right now, and everybody's really scrambling for seats. It's amazing, actually, when you look at it. People of the likes of Colin Brown, Joey Hand, they have like literally nothing right now confirmed in sports car racing. So there's a lot of talented drivers on the market. It's neither of them, I'll tell you that for sure. It's somebody else, but hopefully we'll get some news from GM soon.
If you are a manufacturer looking for a driver, this is the off-season to be in that position, because you do have plenty of good options. Unfortunate for the drivers involved, but on the manufacturer's side, that definitely is a nice little bonus to have your pick from a very talented crop. On to some other topics here, John. Interesting Asian Le Mans series that Suzuka will be the season opener, looking ahead to the 2020-2021 season.
Yeah, this was a bit of a surprise to me, because we hadn't had a Japanese round for this season in Asian Le Mans. The Fuji round had actually been replaced by the new round in Australia at the Bend Motorsports Park near Adelaide. And so we didn't know if there would be a return to Japan, but they've elected to go to Suzuka, which is great news for that track. And sort of interestingly placed in November, on the same weekend as this year's season opener in Shanghai. And it makes you wonder, you know, again, this is pure speculation on my part, but the WEC had put out a questionnaire to teams about a month ago, asking teams to rank certain circuits in terms of their importance, or if they would like to go to it, etc. You know, we saw Kyalami on that list. We saw the Bend actually on that list. But also Suzuka was on that list. And I don't know how long the WEC has the contract for at Fuji, but maybe this could be a bit of a hint of a possible doubleheader with WEC at Suzuka. I don't know. I'm just speculating here. But that date in late November might work a little better, especially now that it's unlikely that WEC will be returning to Shanghai next season. So we'll wait and see what happens. But for the Asian Le Mans series, it's definitely going to be a great season opener. I think that series is growing quite a bit, and we'll have to look and see whether that'll be a fifth round for the season, as rumored, or replacing another event. I would probably put my money on a fifth round for the series, because they're probably not going to get rid of the Chinese round. My guess would be, considering it's an Asian series, but we'll have to wait and see.
The interesting part of the WEC speculation surrounding Suzuka, in my mind, is who owns that track and who owns Fuji, because they're both owned by manufacturers, and one is involved in the WEC and one is not.
Yeah, that is a very good point. Toyota owns Fuji, Honda owns Suzuka. Fair point, you're right. But, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see what happens. I just found it interesting that the WEC was seeking the opinion of the teams on Suzuka.
So, right.
And then all of a sudden we had this announcement come out that, you know, that Asian Le Mans is going there. I'm thinking, that's quite interesting. And especially we've seen the attendance at Fuji drop considerably in the last couple of years. This year's attendance, I believe, was quite low. I wasn't there, but our Dan Lloyd was, and he said it looked pretty bleak. So, having attended Suzuka for the Intercontinental GT Challenge races, there's always a huge crowd there. Not saying one track's better than the other, but Suzuka does have some endurance racing heritage as well. So we'll have to wait and see what happens with the WEC calendar. We should get that released in Bahrain in a few weeks, and hopefully get some clarity there. But again, like I said, I personally wouldn't be surprised if we see maybe a potential doubleheader there.
That would be cool to see. Finally, speaking of Japan and Japanese manufacturers, how about this? Honda looks like they will be back in the Intercontinental GT Challenge powered by Pirelli. At least that seems to be the goal. Where do we stand at the moment?
Yeah, no real huge update there. I think if they are going to be back in IGTC, we should get an announcement imminently, as Bathurst is the season opener in February. That was the race they missed last year, partially due to the lateness of the program coming together, and also the Evo was not allowed to be run there at Mount Panorama. It will be this year, so they can use the same specification car for the full season. I know there's been talks of potentially running two cars with the works team run by Jas, but I think there's a big focus there on trying to get more customers, and it's been a struggle for some manufacturers, including Honda, with GT3 cars, but we've seen the considerable success with that NSX this year in the States, in Europe. I think it won the GT Sports Trophy, Sports Club Series. Also, it had some success in other parts of the world, so it's certainly a viable option. Hopefully, we can get a commitment from them, and we can see the team return and potentially maybe some more cars on the grid in 2020.
More on all of those stories and a whole lot more can be found at sportscar365.com. But that concludes our discussion of the news of the week on this week's show. Let's take our only break at the program this week, and when we return, listener questions to close things out here on Double Stint.
I'm Lawson Ashenbach. You're listening to Sports Car 365's Double Stint Podcast.
Back on Double Stint, let's get to some listener questions now, John. The first one comes in from Masked Cosmo, who says, just a general question for you as a racing fan. Are you able to watch endurance sports car racing on the TV screen when it is nighttime? He says he has always found it difficult because of the headlights flashing straight into the TV screens. Night racing is great if you are at the track in person, but he says he does not think it would attract a casual viewer on the tube. An interesting thought, and I have to agree to a certain extent because I do think it's hard to know what's on the screen when you just see a bunch of headlights coming at you when you are watching from home. And for a casual observer, yeah, I could see the challenge being there. Although I'd say for the sports car enthusiast, that's something that makes the sport a bit unique and something that I personally enjoy.
Yeah, I just looking at what happened to Kyalami, I was first off really shocked that there were not much trackside lighting at the track. And then when it got dark, it was A, really difficult to follow, but B, it was quite a spectacle. And I know I wasn't at home watching it on TV, but I was watching the TV stream in the media center. And yeah, it is difficult. But then again, if you're a fan, I think it's a little bit difficult to identify cars as well in pitch darkness. And even speaking to David Addison, who was calling the race on the international feed, he said he was expressing how difficult it was knowing what was going on, and he really praised the TV cameraman for doing a brilliant job on following the battles on the track, because he himself couldn't really see what was going on. And part of that whole weekend there in Kyalami, it added a bit of mystique to it. You know, I really actually enjoyed that old school kind of feeling where, you know, when you go to a lot of races, night races, you almost expect a certain amount of lighting these days, especially Daytona. I think of Bahrain, for instance, that's run under floodlights. Sebring has a fair amount of lights around the track now these days. So when you all of a sudden have a race in the middle of the night and, you know, finishing at night in complete darkness, I think it sort of adds a lot of excitement. And I can understand fans' concerns by not being able to follow it as much, but I think it's sort of worth the challenge of trying to follow it, but just because it's something so unique.
It's an interesting comment, though, and love to hear what other listeners have to say about that. If you'd like to leave a comment of your own on that subject, we'd certainly welcome that. You can do so in the comment section or by using the hashtag AskDoubleStint. Our next question comes from Matt at Sports Car Racing Every Day, who says, any word on a GT3 Corvette C8 for 2020-2021?
Nothing definitive, and I honestly don't think it's in the pipeline other than a potential Callaway. There is always the chance of the Callaway group creating a C8 version. I haven't really heard much about that. It potentially could be in works there, but in terms of a Pratt & Miller built Corvette, the answer is no. But speaking to Doug Feehan about this, he indicated to me that the C8 GTE car is built very similar to GT3 regulations. So theoretically, you probably could build a GT3 version quite easily. We've seen a lot of cars, you know, that are transferable between GTE and GT3. I think the Ferrari and Aston Martin are the two prime examples. I had a really interesting conversation with John Gaw from Aston Martin while I was in Shanghai, where he told me the whole process of converting a GT3 car to GTE specification. They had to do that with a Vantage that was run by Beach Dean recently for a test in Europe, and he said it basically takes 5 hours and five guys to get it done for an Aston Martin. The big difference being the engine and the electronics. So, you know, I think a GT3 spec Corvette could be possible, but in terms of actually properly having one on the grid and fully supported and whatnot, I don't think that's really in the cards right now.
All right, thank you for writing in, Matt. And lastly, let's get to Tarek R., who writes in and says, good day, John and Ryan. Number one, no customer BMWs in both WEC's GTEM or ELMS's GTE. Is that a manufacturer's choice or a lack of interest from privateer teams in the two championships?
I haven't gotten 100% confirmation on this, but it's my understanding that BMW is a bit reluctant to offer the M8 as a customer car. It's a very complicated car to run, much like the Ford GT. And there had been opportunities potentially from customers to run it. Actually, most namely M-Tech, which was dropped as the factory squad in WEC. That team is still actively looking for a program. And I think if given the chance to run the M8s, I think they probably would have run them as a customer operation. So my belief is that BMW is not looking to sell the cars. Obviously, we don't have 100% confirmation on that, but that's my understanding at least.
And the second question from Tarek R. is going to put a couple of guys in their early 30s on the spot here. He says, FIA WSC Group C versus IMSA GTP. Which series was stronger back in the late 80s and early 90s when we were just kids, John? What do you think?
Well, the tales I hear about IMSA GTP were always pretty strong, so I would have to probably put my money on that, on the Camel GT days of IMSA.
I'll admit that's basically what I have the most knowledge of, and I have to admit as well, that's probably some North American bias here. It's what we grew up around, but yeah, that would be my inclination too, but somebody who was perhaps a bit older or paying closer attention in the late 80s and early 90s could certainly correct us if we're wrong. So feel free to write in the comments for a future show. Well, let's close out here, John, just by letting some folks know on a programming note what's coming up here on our next four shows, as is customary. To close out the year, we have our year-in-review episodes planned. It worked a little better before the WEC switched to the winter calendar, but nevertheless, we'll be pushing ahead, looking back in four consecutive episodes and going deep into some of the seasons here from IMSA, the SRO, the WEC, and the SRO on both sides of the pond. So maybe give folks an idea of what to expect here for the next 4 weeks.
Yeah, the shows will be in a bit of a shorter format, just giving recaps of the season, sharing some of our favorite moments, nominating driver of the year, maybe perhaps some team of the year, race of the year, and just sort of giving a look back on some of the highs and lows throughout each championship. We'll be focusing on the IMSA WeatherTech Championship, I think, next week. SRO America will follow after that. Then we'll get into SRO Europe, which will be between the Blancpain World Challenge Europe season, as well as Intercontinental GT Challenge powered by Pirelli, and then probably finishing it off with WEC. Sort of about a mix of a season, I guess. I guess we'll recap the end of the super season and then talk about the first couple races of this current season, which we still have a race left in this calendar year. So that's why we're going to leave it off to the last possible moment. So, even though racing's sort of coming to a close, we still do have some sports car races on the horizon that we won't be covering directly on this show in the coming weeks. But we have the 8 hours of Bahrain in 2 weeks' time, as well as the Gulf 12 hours, which is actually on the same weekend, believe it or not. I don't understand the scheduling there. One in Bahrain, one in Abu Dhabi, but nonetheless, we got those two races. Got some electric racing in December as well. E-Trophy Andros is kicking off with an all-electric series. You can check that out on E-Racing 365. And you also got Thunderhill, I think, is actually this coming weekend. Haven't heard much about that, actually, though, but that's always an exciting club race that a lot of drivers get behind during the off season. So while we won't be with you every week, you know, on a more newsy basis, we'll be taking that time to do the season reviews, but be sure to check out Sports Car 365 for all of the latest on the website. We'll be sure to keep you up to date through the month of December.
And the first show of the new year is always jam-packed, so we've got that to look forward to as we catch up on news and listener questions. Keep the questions coming in. We may not get to them on the year in review episodes. If something is particularly cogent to our conversation, then we might, but we'll definitely be getting back to listener questions when we get to 2020, which isn't so long from now. All right, that's it for us here this week. Thank you very much for tuning in. We'd love a rating and a review, as always, on iTunes. But with that said, we'll be back with the first of our year-in-review episodes next week on our next edition of Double Stint.